Well, some of you think that that baptism that you had as a baby worked. And some of you, to be called to the front.
Eye daggers.
Yeah. Like looking directly at me.
Yeah. Hi, folks, and welcome to Pastor's Kid, a podcast that explores life, faith, and relationships through the eyes of those who grew up in, out, and through the heart of contemporary religious life. I'm your host, Piper Ramsey Sumner. Today, I'm joined by Simler, aka Grace Baldridge, who uses all pronouns. They're an LA-based musician and content creator who made history with their EP, Preacher's Kid, as the first openly queer artist to hit number one on the iTunes Christian music charts. The project was recorded on a USB mic in her room and explores Simler's experience growing up as a queer person of faith. Following the success of Preacher's Kid, Simler released another chart-topping EP called Late Bloomer, toured with Reliant K, and has amassed over 220,000 followers on TikTok. Simler has been featured on NPR, The Washington Post, and Apple Radio. They're currently hibernating after two headline tours, but look forward to releasing new music in the spring of 2023. I hope you enjoy listening to this conversation as much as I enjoyed having it. All right, we're on. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yes, of course. So the first big question, the obvious one that I have to ask, what makes you a pastor's kid?
Well, my dad is an Episcopal priest. He's retired now, but he was an Episcopal priest and a Navy chaplain. And I grew up in the rectory in Waterloo, Belgium. And that is what makes me a preacher's kid, a PK.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that he was also a chaplain. So does that mean he was in the Navy? And is that why you guys lived in Belgium?
That is not why we lived in Belgium, but he was in the Navy. And he retired as another chaplain. So he went from being a rector at a church in Belgium. And prior to that, he was an associate rector in a church in Delaware. And then when it was like, I don't know, the golden years, like pre-retirement, he was a chaplain for the Ohio River region, and they live in Kentucky, but the river is the Ohio River. I don't know. That's just how things are named. Yeah. And the reason why we moved to Belgium was I think honestly, my dad's ADHD and the sense of adventure and the recent creation of the internet at that time, because he just found a posting for a rector gig in Belgium, probably, you know, fluffed up his resume because he definitely did not speak French, which I think was required for the position. But he did learn it. He did learn French. Okay. He's very quick with languages. So I think he just was like, oh, I can learn languages quickly. And off we went to Belgium.
Wow. Did you learn French?
I did. Yeah. I wouldn't consider myself fluent today, but I would say that if you didn't speak any French and I said something to you, you might think I'm fluent and I don't need to watch French movies with subtitles on.
Okay. So you can impress people.
I can impress people. And there was a time when I would have been fluent. I would have considered myself fluent. But to be very honest, I don't think I'm fluent anymore. And I'm sure that like my parents are so sad to hear that. But it just happens when you don't speak the language every day anymore.
So true. Yeah. Did you use French to woo your wife?
No, romantic. But I do think it made me interesting. It was one of the first things we talked about in a class setting when we had to go around and say where we're from. Mm-hmm. It's always complicated for me. I think now I would say California. I've lived here for long enough. But at that time when we met, I would say I grew up in Belgium. And of course, that sparked a conversation. And she was one of the people that was interested to learn more. So I think it helped a little bit to make me seem more mysterious and interesting than I probably am.
It worked to your advantage, right?
Yeah.
That's funny. So you guys met in college. That's cool.
We did. We met in a class in college, our senior year. Well, it was really her senior year, but I had to repeat a lot of classes. I graduated late because I had a mental breakdown and I'm bad at math.
Mm-hmm. And that happens, you know. It happens. Super senior. That's what they call you.
Yeah. I like that framework. That's really nice way of putting it.
You're just a super senior.
I'm just a super senior.
That's cool. Was it a Christian school?
It was not, but it was a like small liberal arts school in North Carolina that did feel like a conservative country club.
Right, right. I see. Yeah. That's cool. So one of the things with the pastor's kids is like there's the stereotype of them either being this like perfect angel or like a super rebel. Do you think that you kind of fit into those stereotypes, or what do you think about them? And you have a brother too. What do you know about his experience?
Oh yeah. I think I fit into both stereotypes at different times in my life. So I think when I was in the rectory, like in the church environment, living under my parents' roof, I think I was more, you know, gregarious, maybe precocious preacher's kid, but obedient. I wasn't a difficult child, and I didn't really start rebelling until, like, I mean, any kid, like teens into 20s, I would say, is when I started figuring out that I needed some friction with my upbringing. Like I needed to bust out of this joint, basically. And my brother's experience, he is so smart, and he's a really like analytical and thinker. So he always pushed my parents' buttons, specifically on like biblical context and really trying to understand the teachings. Mm-hmm. I remember he read the Bible cover to cover by choice when he was young, because he really wanted to know like what was going on here. He really wanted to like figure it out. I was more so, I'm listening to the sermons, I'm taking in these teachings, but I'm really taking my cues from the social aspects of church, of right. our church culture, and how that was being indicated to me. I was really interested in like Christian media, Christian music. My brother was not. He was in some ways more rebellious than I was, even though he wasn't rebellious outwardly. Like I would like plaster my room with posters at a time, and he wasn't that way. He was really more rebellious in his thinking and sort of like how he would, you know, contend with certain narratives that were presented with. And he still is that way to this day. Like I think he's tried out so many different church services. He's a bit, we are similar in that way, that he'll just go to a lot of different church services just to be like, what is going on here? Like, mm-hmm. I just want to know, like, what's happening?
Yeah. Try different denominations, mm-hmm. high church, low church, all that stuff.
Yeah. He's a very kick the tires type of approach.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a very Jesus, take the wheel. Oh my God, the car is crashing type approach.
Yes. Oh, that's funny. I wonder which one of you stressed your parents out more, you know?
I think we, you know, took turns. Honestly, it was like a tag team effort, because we both, I think, gave, especially in our college years when we were out of the house,
mm-hmm.
we both gave our parents some stress and gray hair that, you know what, we all can laugh about now because we made it through. But at the time, I think it was a bit intense for them.
Yeah, I bet. Just raising a child in general, that's stressful. But and then were they in Belgium while you were in college? Were you guys like that
yes.
far away?
Wow. Yeah. And that was part of the reason why they came back to the United States, was because I was really struggling, the culture shock and my own repression issues with my identity, who I am, finding friends, finding my footing, was very difficult. And I know that my brother had a difficult time as well, but it was different with me because there's the sexuality and gender component. And it was dicey. And so I think that was part of why they needed to be closer, because they didn't want to keep getting phone calls in what was like the middle of the night for them, mm-hmm. About how I was doing. So
mm-hmm.
It's nice to have them back in the States, but I know that we all think very fondly on our time in Belgium. It was a wonderful country and a wonderful city to grow up in. I grew up in Waterloo, and it was just the best. It was a really, really nice time.
What was that? Do you think that you being a pastor's kid, what was that like with you coming to your own with your sexuality and gender and identity? I know you had not just the, your Episcopal church experience, but you also had some influence from like summer camps, and that was more on the evangelical side. And so do you think that all of that, and then on top of that, being a pastor's kid, did that complicate it a lot? What was that like?
Being a, like being a PK in general is a public facing position that you put a kid in kind of without their consent. I mean, it's just very awkward because you are kind of a part of your parents' job because you need to make sure that you are presenting a good public face so that the teachings of my dad's sermons seem consistent. Like, he has a good family life at home. Look at how well his kids are doing. Mm-hmm. And so that burden is placed on the kid to show on Sundays and whatever days of the week else we're in church, look at how good we're doing. That's a weird thing to put on a kid that yes. other jobs don't have. Like, if your dad is an accountant, you're not like, oh, well, look at Timmy. He's also good in math. So that must mean that his dad is a really good accountant. Mm-hmm. So there is this burden that I understood at a young age of just being upstanding in whatever that means. And that's going to be like a cultural context type of thing, because whatever the culture is at your church, that's the standard that you need to meet. Mm-hmm. So you already have that, and then compound it with gender and sexuality, and wherever those conversations were in the 2000s, was far away from where we landed. I think marriage equality was passed in 2015. So prior mm-hmm. to that, it was even in affirming denominations, which the Episcopal denomination was ultimately affirming, it still took the approach of like, this isn't something we're going to talk about. We're not flying pride flags. Mm-hmm. It's inappropriate, but we are loving. It's right. not something that we want to celebrate, but we're not going to shame it. And mm-hmm. so when you take that approach, the outside voices become sort of the guiding influence, and the outside perspective on queerness was shame. And so that's what you believe when there's no other counterpoint to that. And especially in the evangelical youth groups that our church sort of outsourced us into, that was really understood. Like, I just remember one time sitting on a bus on some mission trip or whatever, and just talking about, I don't even remember how it came up, but just there was a conversation about marriage. And one person was like, well, obviously I don't, you know, support gay marriage because we're all Christian. And people just sort of like nodded. And I remember like looking around and thinking that that was the case, like kind of having this inkling, this sinking feeling that that was the case, but just to see like a whole bus be like, well, yeah, obviously that's what it is. It mm-hmm. reinforced this belief that had started to set in because of the outside influences that were not being confronted at my home church, which eventually would become affirming. But you can't be a silent affirmation. You know, the hate directed against queerness is specific. So the love to counteract that needs to be just as specific. And that's definitely something that was lacking in my home church. And it's something that, you know, I've unpacked and talked a lot about with my dad. We have come a long way, and he's a very sweet and loving man. And that was a tricky thing growing up, because then, you know, it lets me know that in order to be the upstanding PK preacher's kid that I need to be, I need not be queer. I need not to explore that side of myself. So then the repression and the shame sets in. And unfortunately, it kind of creates a neuro pathway that will always exist in my little brain. But you can do work on yourself and invest in your self-worth that will make sure that that 13-year-old, 14-year-old voice in your head is not the guiding driver in my day-to-day life.
Yeah. I think shame, I had a therapist say, she said that shame is the one emotion that she thinks is just always negative. Like, there's really no positive results that come from shame, you know? And it's wild how those things will, they do. They just, it gets in deep. It's deep there, you know? And it's a lifelong thing to then unlearn and to heal from. And you were talking about how pastors' kids, you know, it's kind of like a whole family deal when somebody becomes a pastor. And it's kind of like, it made me think of like the Obamas, when I forget the oldest sister who's like gone to college, and how everyone's taking photos of her and they're like, oh, she's smoking cigarettes and drinking. It's like, yeah, she's in college. What else do you do? You know? You know, so all eyes on you. And I was like, I get that to like the tiniest degree, you know, instead of being the whole country or world, it's like this little community, but I get that where there's all eyes on you and the way that you act is somehow a reflection back to your parents and their morality and their holiness and those kinds of aspects. That was even bigger because I grew up in a church that came out of the holiness movement. And so the Holy Spirit, like being filled with the Holy Spirit and being sanctified, that's the word, being sanctified, holy. And so if you were out there sinning, it wasn't evident that God wasn't working through you or that you were keeping the Holy Spirit from being within you or whatever. And that takes everything to this like next level. It's more than just, oh, you made a mistake or, oh, like you're not being a good person. It's like, it's this deeper level of like dirtiness. If you're not being holy, if you're like this, the religious spiritual level is so much deeper and can be so much more damaging when people aren't shamed for it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's tough. And so you were saying that, can you talk a little bit about that experience with you, the youth groups and things that you were a part of, and that they were a little more kind of the evangelical vibe. What was that like? Did your parents, did they have an awareness of how different it was?
I don't think so. So we were part of an expat community in Belgium, and that sort of made up whatever youth group experience I had, because the English-speaking churches within the Waterloo area there weren't that many of them. There was just this idea that let's just combine all the youth groups. And many of us went to the same school, or we went to maybe three to four of the schools in the area. It's a small country. It's a small town that we just sort of, you know, combined forces. And there's a more zealous approach to youth ministry in the evangelical tradition than in my experience, the mainline Christian, liturgical heavy churches. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that is. Well, I can probably unpack why that is, like get them when they're young. And if you, and certain things, like if you, implement shame and fear at a young age, those are powerful tools to control people. And I think that religion obviously has been used as a weapon of control over time. And so I think that I think back on like these youth leaders that were so young, like so many of them were like 24, you know, at the time that feels so old to you when you're 15, but they're young. Like, I don't think that they were like, yeah, I'm going to control these like little kids. Like there were some that I like think back on very fondly and would love to revisit and kind of unpack our experiences, because in some ways, like their brains weren't fully formed either. And they're shipped over to Belgium to like proselytize to teenagers. Mm-hmm. What? Like, that's such an odd, like I'm sure many of them are probably listening to podcasts like yours, and like we've found ourselves in similar spaces, though our paths haven't crossed yet. So I think that they're like a symptom of how religion has been weaponized, but I don't think they're the mega minds behind it. Right. You know, I think that oftentimes vulnerable populations like that are also used. Someone in their early 20s who like doesn't really know exactly what direction they want to go to in their life, and they have this core foundation of a religious belief, and then someone tells you like, wow, Belgium is a real secular country, they are legalizing gay marriage, you got to get over there, you got to save the kids. I might be susceptible to that as well. But yeah, that was pretty much, it was like a young life adjacent, or actually young life type of the youth group environment. And certainly, yeah, some people more unsavory than others, but theologically I disagree with absolutely everything that was taught. I also think the whole framework of how we were reached was creepy often because like just thinking back, because there were some leaders that I'm like, you should have known better. Like there's a couple of guys that were like in their 30s or 40s, like they were like adult men that would like hang around our school, and they picked out who the popular kids were, and then they started like organizing a youth group, but it was like just a meetup around these kids. And so of course that's like a huge draw. Like literally the prom king and queen were major draws, like targets to get us to go. I don't think it was literally like, if you go, then like you'll be close to the, but it was so implied. It was like, oh, who goes to these breakfasts? Who goes to these things?
Right.
And they got them in. And then of course, you know, my little like bright eyed bushy tailed ass is like, well, I want to start going to breakfast too. Like I want to go see what they're talking about. And then you learn about it and you're like, oh my God.
It's a little different than what my dad talks about.
His breakfast is a huge bummer.
Yeah. Yes. Now I'm worried about my salvation while I go to math class. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh gosh. I have lots of thoughts about how they go about doing youth groups and stuff. I had a youth pastor who was 19. I went to a really, our church was very small. He had been in the church and then he left and then came back when he was 19 and was like, God's calling me to be a youth pastor. My dad's the pastor. And so he was like, sure. Mm-hmm. And my older sister was a senior in high school. So he's only like a year and a half older than her. And so she didn't listen to a single thing he said. She argued with him like all day long, which was really fun for like camp and stuff to watch Megan like argue with the youth pastor. But yeah, I was like, his brain is so far from being developed enough to make smart decisions. I was like, how do we trust him to like drive the church van and take us on overnight trips and stuff?
Mm-mm. Yeah, I think that like the accountability from a 19-year-old versus like a 35-year-old guy or whatever that I would look for is just dramatically different. I think that both people you can take issue with in their role in ultimately damaging the, like, to put it mildly, I would say self-esteem, but doing a religious trauma at a kid from a 19-year-old versus a 35-year-old, like I do qualify those things very differently, because that 19-year-old was just like 2 years shy of being one of those kids themselves. And we know that the way that abuse works is that it is perpetuated. Like if you were like harmed by it, you are more likely to harm others.
Right.
You're like in that cycle of it.
Still inside it. Yeah.
You're still inside of it. You know, you can't really see like the forest for the trees. So I think about that sometimes with, especially the women that were youth leaders that were just like, you know, really like at the beginning of their whole lives, like in this country where they didn't speak the language, just kind of sent over to, for like, again, it's just like, what was the pitch? Were we that fallen?
We're sending you to be missionaries to all of these Christian kids who just live in another country, but they're all still Christian kids.
They're Christian, but there was definitely something that I remember hearing because of the Episcopal denomination that I was affiliated with. I heard a lot about how we weren't really Christian or we weren't Christian enough, or some people would get baptized again had they gone through our church and they'd go to like another church or something. And that's hilarious to me because I know that the Episcopal denomination has really grown in many ways, but at the time that I was growing up in it, like it still felt like pretty serious churchy. So I just remember being like why are people getting baptized again? And they're like, because it wasn't like that, they didn't know the true Christ. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
What are we talking about every Sunday then? I'm so confused.
Well, maybe it's because it's too close to Catholic. And I know I had a Sunday school teacher who, we did this class, like a series that was like, you know, religions of the world or not, you know, other religions. And we did one on Catholics. And I was like, I went to a Christian school, like in elementary through high school. And I was like, one of the girls in my class is Catholic, like at my Christian school and participates in like Bible class and stuff. And she's like, they're not Christian. So maybe the Episcopals are too close.
I think it's probably something in that headspace.
Yeah. So funny. Did you get baptized more than once or one and done?
No, I got baptized once. I've been in environments where it was invited, but I always kind of enjoyed the fact that I was baptized as a baby, because those environments where it's like, come, if the Spirit moves you, like, we want to invite you, who wants to get baptized today, like that type of thing. I, for someone who performs for a living, which is still such an embarrassing job, I really don't like that type of attention. Like, it was, even if the church service that day, like, did kind of slap and I was like, ooh, I am feeling the Spirit, like, wow, I'm moved. The prospect of walking down an aisle to get baptized, to be drenched in water in front of friends and crushes, absolutely not. So I remember being like, whoopsie, can't go. Already got it.
No need, not me. Oh my gosh, yeah. I was like self-conscious about raising my hands. I was like, people are going to look if I raise my hands during the worship set or whatever.
I used to try it. What I would do to kind of get away with it, because it is, again, it's such a social experiment, church, and like how you behave and how people are like perceiving you and other people. We can pretend that it's not, but it is. It really, really is. It's just like a little, you know, study on how humans behave in different environments as set to music and praise and worship power chords. But what I would do, because I didn't want to raise my hands, is I would like do like a low hand right here. So it looks like you're like receiving.
Yes. 90 degree.
Yeah. 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 You're receiving the Spirit. And it's enough that if someone like looks over, they're like, are like, Grace is in it.
Yeah.
Cause I liked singing. I liked the singing along. The songs were fun, but I didn't, it wasn't like, here I am, call on me, or enough for like a leader to come ask me about how the service went afterwards. Cause I didn't want that. I really didn't want to talk.
Yeah. You're like, I'm good, guys.
I'm good. I'm like, I'm here. Oh, I'm here. But it's just a low hand. It's just a low hand that is an active low hand.
It's like, what was that one movie, Hitch, where he teaches him how to dance? He's like, stick it right here. It's like a nice, comfortable spot, just right here. A sweet spot.
Yeah. You could absolutely do that for like ways to participate in church services without, you know, given the full shebang.
Sometimes I'm sad because, so I grew up in the Church of the Nazarene, and they used to be they're kind of Pentecostal adjacent, like the movement came out around the same time. And people used to have tambourines and run the aisles and do all that kind of stuff. But by the time I was growing up, there was none of that. Maybe like a hand raise or two, you know, during the worship service. And I was like, that kind of would be kind of fun. You get all your energy out.
Yeah.
A little bit cathartic, you know, just like going to a concert or something, you know?
I mean, that's why the praise band services were the most fun.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, there's just, it becomes interactive. You're clapping, call and response. You're doing rounds. Like one half of the congregation is doing this. The other half is doing this. Like it's a group activity at that point. And if you pull it off, if you can hear, like, we're singing, and I will raise you up on eagle's wings, and it's sounding good and people are hitting harmonies, even if you're not moved in the Spirit that day, you're like, we sound good. Like God should love this.
Yeah.
We are crushing this. The rhythm section is locked in.
Yes.
People are clapping on beat. Which was not always the case, to be honest with you.
And then you ride that high till the next Sunday.
Yes. Oh, you ride the high. Yeah. And then it sucks though, when you have a huge mega service like that, the next, like usually after like a big Easter or Christmas service, the next service is just like such a slump.
Yeah, that's true.
That's got to be hard for my dad, like just thinking of like the preaching dynamics of it all, to feel like you had, because he's not a person, you're not immune to like what your nervous system goes through when you're performing for people. Now I know that it's like, well, a sermon isn't performance. Yes, the fuck it is. Yeah. It absolutely is. Like
your adrenaline goes up. And...
Yeah, like you have that, especially for a big one, like Easter or Christmas. I mean, I remember... One time my dad did a Christmas Eve service that honestly flopped, and it was meant to be like this sort of puppet show thing, but like none of the puppets worked. And I know, I felt, and it's like a uniquely embarrassing thing when like it's your dad and you're just like, oh shit, like this isn't going well. And it's a packed house and it's not going well. And he was like so bummed because he felt like he let the congregation down. and he was embarrassed. And that's a performance. That's showbiz, baby. Like, that is how you would, like, that feeling that he's feeling is probably how someone would feel on, like, an off-Broadway show or something. And the critics didn't, like, it didn't go over well. And then it's compounded with the burden of giving people spiritual enlightenment. And you didn't even, and you didn't deliver on that either. Like, I can only imagine.
It's like God's disappointed in you. You didn't
peaks and valleys. Like, that's nuts. That's a nuts job.
That's part of, I think, the training that I think you get when you're in seminary and things like that is like, you're going to get some flops. Not everything is going to work out. You know, people have to kind of be reassured that it's not going to, you know, go great. Did your dad, I remember my dad, especially when he would try something new, he, after the service, one of the first things, like when we would give hugs and stuff, he would ask my mom, how'd it go? You know, and she would like give a little, it was great, wonderful, love this, love that. Yeah.
My mom was definitely a sounding board for my dad. He would usually rehearse his sermons in the on Sunday mornings, because he'd do the early service, and then he'd come home, and then he would like rehearse while he was like getting ready for the later, for like the 10 or 11 service or whatever. And I just have these memories of him like sitting in this like chair in my parents' room. My mom's like putting on her earrings and he's like running through his bits. And she was a really good reviewer. She's also was an elementary school teacher, and she's especially strong with teaching English. And so I always thought that her edits to my dad's sermons were very precise and helpful. And yeah, I remember those conversations a lot. If ever a sermon was too long, that was definitely something that she'd be like, you gotta, it's gotta be like 15 minutes or else we're like, 15 to 20 is like the safe spot. There was one sermon that went to like 30. And I remember it was like a thing, like people were mad.
An issue. People start tapping their watches.
Yeah. I'm like, don't you want to receive the good news? Oh, is the good news taking too long for you?
Well, if it's the later service, then it's about lunchtime and something
yeah, angry. That's true.
I can't believe there's some churches people preach for like an hour. Mm-hmm. What is there to even say for that long?
I went to a church service that was 4 hours long. I'm not exaggerating. Mm. It was one of the situations that we talked about before we started recording, which is when people will sometimes invite me to their churches. To just, you know, be like, well, our church, we hear your music similar, and we think that you might want to check out this type of a church, this type of a service. And so long as my, you know, safety and well-being is guaranteed, and I'm not going to be like called up to the front, like, I'll go check out your church service. But one of them was 4 hours long, and I brought a friend with me just because I didn't want to go by myself. And I just remember being like, God, okay, this is a lot. But it wears you down in such a way that like I would tithe at that point if I was like, how many tithes do we need to get out of here? Like, I'm ready to pledge. Yes. I'm going to do a monthly donation if we can leave.
Yeah, they use exhaustion maybe a little bit.
I definitely felt that.
It's like the last night of summer camp. They always call it cry night, because that's when you're desperate and just exhausted and have a sunburn. And so then they're like, we're going to bring the real message or whatever.
Yeah.
You're probably not saved. That's what I remember. That big
You probably think you're saved. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, that's like one of the worst. I hate that so much.
Well, some of you think that baptism that you had as a baby worked. And some of you...
Eye daggers.
Yeah. Like looking directly at me.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, and then you were talking earlier about like not wanting to have attention on you and stuff. So what was that like being the pastor's kid? Cause you just inherently have eyes on you. And did you like enjoy that? Was it like kind of a point of pride?
I think to a degree. It was really fun when I was in kindergarten. Because the kindergarten that I went to, or maybe it was the pre-K, was affiliated with my dad's church at the time. It was like a connected to the church. And it was just cool to be like, yeah, my dad works for God, because that's how I understood it. So that clout I enjoyed. I do think that being a preacher's kid contributed to the fracture of personality that I enjoy to this day, which is to say that like I have a public facing persona, which is similar, and music and the things that I put out on the internet. And people might have some understanding of who I am through that. It's not true, but it really is a fraction of who I am that I choose to share. And then there's people who know me in my day-to-day life as Grace. And it's a very different side of who I am and how I behave. I'm actually not like the loudest, most outgoing person in my friend group by any stretch. I love the friends that I have, but I think I understand from my upbringing, having a public face and a private life. And I don't necessarily, it's like, I don't know. It's just how I am. And so I can't really say that I dislike it or anything. If anything, it's a skill that I'm happy to have at this time in my life, because with any more sense of like people knowing who I am publicly, it's nice to already have that private sense of self that was cultivated as a child. Because I just knew when I would go to church on Sundays, like, all right, showtime.
Yeah. For sure. Did you have to, did that include dressing up? Did you have to wear dresses?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Oh, it was awesome. So brutal.
In the 90s, it was like, yeah, like fluffy dresses with lace and puffy sleeves.
Huge sleeves. Just the fluffiest, poofiest dresses.
Yes. And those socks with the lace around the edge of it.
Oh my gosh. It was awful. And I was such a tomboy. I could have been really such an easy kid to dress, because all I wanted was my brother's hand-me-downs. I would just sneak into his room and just take his hand-me-downs.
Just let me wear his slacks.
That's all I needed. Like, you would have just never needed to buy clothes for a second kid. But something I've talked about and unpacked a lot with my mom now is that it's why it's so important to combat against bills like Don't Say Gay laws, right? Because if at that time language had existed, because I would throw biblical tantrums. I would be like ripping clothing off of me.
No,
I would cut my own hair. Oh yeah. Sunday morning. It was, I like to say that like eventually I think I was just so sort of subdued because I just wasn't going to win this that I stopped putting up such a fit. But there were like years of time where it was temper tantrums every Sunday, and my mom was just like, she just didn't get it. Like, she would just be like, I just don't know what to do here. Had language, had educational materials existed that was like, hey, maybe your kid is this way, maybe just see if their behavior might change if we allowed Grace to, you know, wear whatever her brother's wearing to church on Sunday.
Right.
Let's just see what happened. But it didn't exist. But I think that had it been the case, it would have been life-changing. And that's why representation and visibility is so important, because I think that very fortunately, my parents are just so really compassionate. They really love me, and they really, I think, feel a sense of guilt for the things that they didn't know and maybe they weren't paying attention to, and that socially they were conditioned to not discuss all that stuff. We've worked through a lot of things. And I think that, like, my mom and I just talked about this at Christmas, because she was like, I don't know if I'd like to think that I would have been better had I had the information today, but I don't know. And I was like, Mom, you would have, because you are doing it now. You know, like, if you just, I didn't know terms like non-binary or genderqueer. We didn't have anything like that. So if I didn't even have that language, then how am I expecting you? You're just like, what is wrong with this kid? Like, what is her problem with dresses? Like, this is a weird fit that she's going through. But now there's so much more language and representation. And as that's developed, I've seen my mom really open up and have this curiosity for just caring for people, caring for queer kids, especially. It's like a real heart that she has for queer kids from religious environments that are not, because to her, it's like, I just don't, you know, come on. Like, if I can even get with it, and she's in her 70s, she's like, what's happening? I don't understand the problem. Like, yeah, Mom, like, that's same girl.
Do you ever wonder, like, if our parents' generation, like, if those terms and things like that, what, your parents' expressions about their own gender and things like that would have been different. I always wonder.
Always wonder. And also, I'm such a little annoying gnat to my parents these days because we've gone through so much together that there's nothing that's really off limits. I ask them all the time. I'm like, how do you know you're straight? Like, do you? Like, oh, how do you identify? Like, what feels good for you? I'll like check in. I'll be like, pronouns, how do we feel? just to normalize it, but also because I do think that that generation was, they really did sort of miss out on what I think is a very exciting touch point in human history for exploring and understanding the gender and sexuality spectrum and how that just helps us understand the multitudes within each person.
And it just, having that understanding, I know, because, you know, growing up without any of that, with just the binary heteronormativity, and then being able to, like, my world just being expanded more and more, it makes humanity so much more, like, I don't know, beautiful, and it's more like of an enriching thing to think about. And also in terms of like spirituality and stuff, and think about all the depths of like what that means with God, and what does, you know, God is not limited by our human definitions, if humans aren't even limited by human definitions. And just, it just creates this kind of like ever unfolding, opening, expansive, beautiful thing that I love to explore and think about, you know.
It's amazing how everything cracks open for me. Like, I think that my faith was in this weird, at this weird sort of impasse before I really accepted my queerness as a blessing and viewed it not as this like burden or anything to be ashamed about. When I really started working on that and viewed who I am as a spiritual being having a human experience and the purpose that I was created to be here, that there wasn't a mistake about me, like there, because I always used to be like, there's something wrong with me, and that there wasn't anything wrong. And also, that was very tied to that sort of discovery within myself, was tied to, why am I always thinking of God as a man? Why is God always a man, an old man, specifically an old white guy? Like, why do I believe that? Why is that my understanding? When we hear like in the Bible that God is referred to like God the Father, like, why are these very like kind of traditional, why am I boxing God into this box of how I understand in Western white culture fatherhood to be? Why don't I break open that box and explore the mystery of divinity and God? And in so doing, I had this curiosity about my faith that I hadn't had before. Like, but it was, it was confronting at first. I remember just being in conversation with someone and was like, yeah, I call God mother. That's how I pray. And being like, you can do that. Like, do they know that you're doing that? Like, are you allowed? And just, it really opened up the possibility of a relationship to the divine that didn't need to be within the parameters of the church that I grew up in when I was 12 or 13, that it's possible. I know that my father is a kind and loving man, and I know he's not a perfect man also. And I don't think that he would say, or that he would want me to believe, that his interpretation of the Bible is the right one. So why am I like putting all of this on just the people who taught me this language? Why am I being like, they're correct, they're correct, they're right? Like, I need to expand my understanding. I need to learn from different traditions and cultures. And I had this curiosity for other religions as well. Like, it was just, everything just cracked open for me. And I'm thankful that that has been the case, but it all kind of started for me of like, why do I think of like this Zeus person on a cloud? Like, why am I thinking of Santa Claus when I'm praying? I need to not. That's not helpful.
Yes. I love that. I think I feel similarly. Like, I remember the first time I was like, oh, I could think of God in a different way. And so Christian college. And so we had chapel twice a week. And I remember I just to myself, while we were singing the songs, replacing the pronouns he with her. Mm. And I was like, and I had like this next, like I had like a more, even more spiritual kind of experience because it was so much more like profound. And it just like, just kept opening up all these different things for me. And it was really cool. And it made me feel, because I always, that was something I always struggled with growing up, was all of the misogyny that in the patriarchal stuff that is just so ingrained, especially in more conservative Christianity. And I remember holding my Bible out to wherever it was in Timothy or whatever that says women should be silent in church, and being, telling God, like, if this is from you, then I don't think I can believe in you. I can't believe in a God like that. And so that was always a big kind of struggle for me. And so being able to think like, oh, God has, if we are made in the image of God, all of us, then God can have and does have all of these feminine attributes as well as masculine and everything in between, and then all different iterations. And yeah, I just love that so much.
Completely.
So what has that been like then to explore that through your music? So that's kind of, that's how I found you, is that you were on TikTok and you were talking about music, that you were writing. You had your Preacher's Kid album that was number one on the Christian music charts, which was a big deal because you were like openly queer, like check out this, you know, it was very cool. And that kind of, I think that was what got your music like really started, was when that happened. And you started, you've since then released two more EPs that have also been top charts. And then you also got to tour with people like Reliant K, which is so cool. My older sister, that was her, like, that was her band in high school, was Reliant K. And so it's so cool to think that you got to like hang out with them and stuff. But what has that been like doing that, exploring your music and kind of finding yourself as this well-known name in music and specifically in the contemporary Christian world, music world?
Well, I always say that if I could go back in time as I am now and tell my 13-year-old self that we are a Christian music artist, I likely would have punched myself in the face and said, oh my God, we never got out. because it would be missing the context of how I came into writing Christian music, which is that I really moved to Los Angeles from college and locked away any sort of deconstruction or questioning or unpacking that I needed to do about my upbringing and my faith into a neat little box that I just never touched. I would be asked about how it was being queer and having my dad be a priest and growing up and all this stuff, and I would just like deflect the question, like, oh, super cool, it was fine, it was no big deal, everything was good, because it wasn't, you know how it is, it wasn't cool how we were brought up. And also it often feels like, I don't know, it feels like sometimes a bummer, like just bringing people down a little bit to unpack it. And it was just a lot for me. I really didn't want to touch it. It was not, these were not pleasant memories. And then things started cropping up in my personal life that coincided with lockdowns. I just couldn't ignore the conversations within myself anymore. And I've always been writing music, but that was like a door. I never wanted to write about it. I just didn't want to, because it was just, I didn't know what was going to come up. And there is that fear of the unknown. But during lockdown, I was not working for some months and I just started writing. And once I started, I couldn't stop. Once I discovered TikTok and these conversations that were happening that helped me feel less alone, helped me find community and people who were saying that, listen, maybe I grew up in a different denomination than you. We went to different youth groups. We grew up on different continents. But I understand where you're coming from. Like writing some of the most personal music of my whole life and having people say, me too, I understand that as well, was so encouraging. It was so just affirming. It just let me know that I was, that I, this whole time, I didn't need to feel ashamed. And once I started writing, it's like I just couldn't stop and I haven't been able to stop since. And some of the music that I've released hasn't all been about my religious experience, but something I'm kind of making peace with now that actually feels really cool to talk about with you is like, I was talking about this with my wife when I was finishing up the new music on this new project that's coming out. And some of it is like some of the most explicitly Christian stuff I've ever done. And then there are other songs that are not as on the nose, maybe. But it's all from the lens of like me being a preacher's kid. Like the relationships in some of the songs where you won't hear Jesus in them at all is influenced by my preacher's kid upbringing. Like the reason why there's a whole song about this thing is because something happened and it was influenced by how I grew up and how you grew up and how we got to this sort of breakdown in a relationship is all because of the Christian culture that we are trying to work our way through. So it feels really cool to have found my footing. I feel really inspired and motivated, so heartened by the community. That has been incredible, getting to perform live shows. And it also feels a little odd because it's sort of like I somehow like wound up here, and it was never intentional, but it feels meant to be. It wasn't like a plan or anything. And I think that's what's, in a weird way, it's very like let go and let God. I hate to say that expression, but it just wasn't like, it just wasn't planned. But also I'm so not going to censor anything that I'm writing about. And this is clearly where my head is in and where my heart is at. So it feels important to see this season through, and I'm thankful for the people who have come along with me. Wow, that was a really Christian answer. Do you see, I said, see this season through.
I know.
Let go and let God.
Yes. It's great. Good stuff.
You don't get it out of your vocabulary. Like that, you can be in a conversation with someone at a party and they'll say something and I'll be like, did you go to youth group? And it'll be something unrelated, but it'll just be like a vernacular where it's like the only way that you know that is because you know who Rebecca St. James is.
Yes. That happened to me the other day. I was talking about a church being affirming, and I have friends that are not churchy, and they were like, what does that mean?
I know.
Like, yeah, I was like, oh, I thought that was just the word for it. For like, it just, I don't know. So it's funny. Christian ease is what, I hope that's an okay way to say, but that's why I've always heard it said. Yeah. And how cool is it to know, I wonder what that was like for you to, you know, you start kind of putting music out there and then you get this response of all these people, like you said, who are like, I get it. Same page, you know, kind of thing because that can be a tough thing going through any kind of change, but this kind of big change where your religious world and your spiritual and your upbringing and everything gets kind of flipped. And it can feel really isolating, like you're the only person. And that's also kind of why I started this podcast, because the pastor's kid experience is so unique. And so being able to tell our stories, other pastor's kids can hear them. And then other pastor's kids can send these little podcasts to their friends and family and say, hey, this is what it was like. So just so you know, to know you're not the only person who's experienced it.
Yeah, that's been the best part of getting to tour and play shows as well, is my hope is that we're not picking at a scab here, but creating a space for healing and community. And I always say at our shows, like, I understand what I write songs about. Like, I wrote Bethlehem, I know the lyrics, I know what it's about, and I understand that it's kind of heavy and it could bring up some stuff for you. But I promise you, as a band, as a touring company, we are going to do our very best to make sure that you leave here tonight feeling a little bit better than when you came in. Like, it's not, I really don't want to wallow. I want to heal. And the way that I'm doing that, the way that I've always known ever since I was little, one of my coping skills, maybe my only coping skill because I'm so bad at exercising, is writing songs. And that's what I can offer. And if that's something that you're interested in, like, I will, you know, I will continue to do that and to share what I'm going through with you and hope that it helps your walk become a little bit easier. But I don't want to contribute to any more harm than some of the stuff that we're already unpacking. I want to create something different, and you know, and I don't think I'm for everybody, but if I am for you, then that's what my hope would be.
Yeah. That was going to be one of my questions, was how long have you been doing music, and were you ever in a worship band?
I was never in a worship band. I was never a worship leader. The power would have been too much.
Yeah. Would have gone to your head, you think?
No, I don't. I think it would have gone to my head.
You'd be living in Nashville.
I know. I would have like just fully been, would have sold out. I always loved writing songs. Some of my earliest memories are songs that I would write in my brain when I was like 6 or 7. There's like a little radio that plays kind of constantly. And when I'm in conversation with someone, like right now, it'll turn down. But when I am struggling with sleep, which is something I'm going through right now, it'll turn up at night. And it's just jingles, sometimes about like my dogs or my wife, but then sometimes it's a song. And so I've always had that as like a coping skill. And I taught myself, you know, guitar and piano around like 12 or 13. I'm not very good at either, but enough to write music. Yeah. And what was the other part of that question? It was like writing music and, oh, worship band. No, I never got to do it. I sang a little bit in choir, but I think there was something, I really didn't love being seen in a performance way until I started looking more like myself, if that makes sense. Yeah. So I would sing and I would write things, but I didn't like being perceived in a musical way until I started looking like myself. Cause it just felt, there was like this cognitive dissonance of like, no, you're not seeing, don't. And now I feel better. Yeah.
Yeah. I get that for sure. Yeah. I think, you know, coming into your own and being able to feel like you are fully yourself. And so then you can, then it feels better about putting yourself out there because it's you, you know, it's not
completely.
Yeah. And maybe like the idea of being in front of people when you don't feel like you're fully yourself, it almost exposes that tension, you know? It's like, now I have to think about how I'm not being myself. So,
yeah.
Okay. So I got a couple more questions.
Okay.
So imagine if you were going to sit down with your younger self, you were talking about if you would talk to your 13-year-old self, what if you were sitting down with little Grace, what would you want to tell them?
I would say that everything you're feeling right now is true and it's real, but it won't always hurt this badly. And I would also really emphasize, because I remember thinking this so much, you are not alone. You're not the only person who's ever felt this way in human history, because I used to be convinced. I was like, no one has ever been this heartbroken in this way before. I was like, in some ways, I'd be like, wow, this is a feat. This must be like a world record. If only I could share it with anyone to be this sad. And so I would say, no, that's not true. And a lot of people are going through something really similar. And trust yourself, be a lot kinder to yourself. If I was talking to myself when I was 13, I'd be like, listen, you get to be 17. You're going to be so mean to yourself. Don't do it. Now you're 13. You have time. I want to like embolden you. There's like a certain magic that you have that it's going to start going away when you are like hitting puberty, because you're going to try and change who you are. I think you probably, I don't know if anything was different, I probably wouldn't be here. So I guess I would just say you're doing the best that you can. You're not alone. And life is going to get really good. You're going to have to wait, and it's going to feel like a long time, but it's going to get really good. And I would also say that a lot of your high school friends, almost all of them, are still in your life today. You have good high school friends.
Wow.
You should trust them more.
That's good.
What would you say?
To my younger self?
Yeah. 13. 13 is a pivotal age, because it is like before.
That's what, like 7th grade or something?
Yeah.
Oh God. I'm pretty sure I had really bad anxiety and a lot of hell anxiety. So I'd say you're not going to go to hell. You're probably not even going to believe it, that it exists when you get older. So don't worry about it. You deserve love. You're not ugly. You'll be awkward, but you'll be less awkward, and embrace the things that you like. And it's okay that you like things that are different than what other people like.
That's a good
I've always been weird and nerdy and enjoyed things that are perceived as weird and nerdy. And so that was a struggle. I wanted to be cool so bad, but I was not.
Yeah. Never. And the coolest kids, like, have you ever been around, maybe you have like a younger cousin or someone, like the coolest kids that I've gotten to meet are the ones with just their interests. Like that's what, it's been very transformative now as an adult to like see, I like meet my cousins or like Lizzie's cousins that are younger and just like you, like my sister-in-law, when I met her, she's like 8 years younger than Lizzie. So she was a teenager when we met. And I remember being so intimidated by her because she had like cool girl energy that I never was able to access.
Yeah.
And I'm sure she would like listen to this now and like laugh and be like, no, I was so insecure, blah, blah, blah. But she had it. Like she really liked what she liked. I remember asking her like what music she was into. She had like a specific answer and she was like, and there it is. I was like, I would have been like, well, what music do you like?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yes. That's something else I would tell myself. Don't shape who you are around just to make other people happy. Cause I do a lot of that. Even still, that's hard for me. And okay. My last thing, another piece of advice you have to give to pastors who are raising pastors' kids right now. What's your advice to them?
Okay. I think that as best as you can, try to remove your kid from bearing any responsibility over the vocation that you've chosen. So this kind of happened later, like my senior year of high school, like the last year I lived with my parents, I was really not liking to go to church and I was in like a tense spot. And it was actually like, as soon as my mom talked to my dad about like letting up on me going, like just basically being like, we've got to give her some space, that I was able to almost like look at my dad's job and what he did with a new appreciation for the work that he was putting in because it didn't belong to me anymore. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't something that we shared. So almost like if you love your preacher's kid, let them go. And if they come back, then cool. And if they don't, also cool. But I just think that my advice to raising a kid in this way is like, let them be themselves. Listen to who they are when they tell you. What an amazing thing when a kid lets you in on the mystery that it is to be a human, you know, to have consciousness. Listen to that. Wow, that's incredible that they feel safe enough to share things with you. And yeah, I think as in a weird way, it's like, I know that it's your calling. I get it. But try to not make it the whole family's day job also.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's tricky. I don't know how you do that, but
It is tough.
Yeah. My dad made a comment recently. He was like, what if one day you want to go to seminary? I'm like, and I won't. Thank you though. Thank you so much for playing. That's not why I'm writing music.
I think that's like a dad thing or just a parent thing. You know, they want you to go follow their path maybe a little bit.
Yes.
My dad did the same. Cause I did go to seminary. So I got that far.
You did it.
Yeah.
Got one.
Yeah. But I don't ever want to be, I'm not interested in being ordained or going down like that path. Cause lots of reasons, but so at least we have that part, me and my dad, but.
Well, I'm ordained in the Unitarian Universalist Church so that I can get my friends married. And yes. I've done two weddings so far.
I did the same. I think I've done two weddings also, so.
Yeah, hey. So I'll be ordained in that regard.
Yes, that's fine. I can do your wedding.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, cool. Okay, so, well, thank you so much for joining me. This has been an awesome conversation. Where can people find you online? What can they expect from you in the next couple months?
Well, you can find me at Grace Baldridge on Instagram and Twitter, my government name. You can find me at Semler on TikTok. You can listen to all my music under Semler, wherever fine music is found. And this year, you can expect a lot more new music from me. And I know that people say this all the time, but I really truly believe that it is the best music I've ever written or recorded, and I can't wait to share it. And I just want to take my time to give it the work and the detail that I know it needs. But I'm so excited for everyone to hear it. And just thank you to anyone listening who's come to a show or streamed a song of mine. I'm so, so thankful. And it's really been wonderful to find a new sense of community the past few years.
Awesome. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Yay. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode of Pastor's Kid. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and please rate, review, and subscribe on whatever platform you're listening through. Our theme music is Brushmaster by Yure. Find him on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm your host, Piper Ramsey Sumner. See you next time.